This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Just a few weeks ago, Walter Hickson, a distinguished professor of history at the University of Akron, spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Hickson specializes in the history of U.S. foreign policy, and he recently published a book entitled American Settler Colonialism, A History. In it, he contends that over the course of three centuries, American settlers spread throughout North America and beyond, driving out indigenous populations to establish exclusive and permanent homelands of their own. He writes that our predecessors helped to create the richest and most powerful nation in human history, even as they caused the death and displacement of millions of people. Hickson uses evidence and sociology to link episodes of historical conflicts to argue that the United States has always been a settler colonial society as a way of understanding America's rise to global dominance. Professor Hickson spoke on March 26, 2015, in front of an audience of students and faculty at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah.
This study I've done is a result of going back in time. That's what we historians do, and most of my work has been on the Cold War. And my earlier books dealt with the history of the Cold War, but I kept feeling a sense of a need to go deeper, to understand more underlying, more fundamental, maybe even more structural issues that played out in modern American foreign policy. And this burrowing backward sort of never stopped. And I ended up going all the way back and conceptualizing American history more in this context of settler colonialism. So let me talk about that a little bit, and then we'll run through some American history, some examples of settler colonization, and also the violence inherent in that project, and conclude with some reflections and examples of settler colonial society as it still exists today. What is settler colonialism? One way to define it is to distinguish it from kind of traditional colonialism. And the basic fundamental distinction is that under colonialism, let's say the French in Indochina or the Dutch in the East Indies, under traditional colonialism, the colonizer is there to exploit labor and to extract natural resources, typically, for example, rubber in French Indochina, spices in the Dutch East Indies, for profit. But the colonizer eventually will leave, whereas under settler colonialism, the settler stays. That's the fundamental difference. Settlers then are engaged in removing the indigenous populations where they settle, not in exploiting their labor. They're less interested in that than in removing them in order to make way for waves of settlement. So these are some of the fundamental distinctions between colonialism and settler colonialism. Settler colonies typically perceive themselves as a chosen people, even a sacred mission for their settler expansion. And often this is closely tied with a religious component. And this functions as a justification for settlement and removal of indigenous populations. So what settler societies do is create facts on the ground. In that sense, settler colonialism, and really this is a relatively new arena of study. There was a journal started by this name in 2008, and so we're still kind of evolving this concept of settler colonization. But one of the aspects of it is it's structural, it's permanent. So as I've already mentioned, the settler comes to stay, not to exploit and leave and eventually go back to the homeland, but to make a new homeland, a sacred homeland, a chosen homeland. And inevitably, this entails violence because other homelands, indigenous homelands, already exist where settlers go to make their new homes, their new sacred chosen lands. Some other aspects of this, typically settler societies, history is a troubling subject for them. There's denial structured into settler societies, and we can conceptualize this with such terms as virgin land or wilderness, as if these colonies were uninhabited rather than already being peopled and people being removed for new settlement. Often this precipitates history wars. In the 1990s, we had cultural wars in the United States. Part of that had to do with indigenous sovereignty movements. Australia was roiled by history wars in the 1990s over the history of settlement and dealing with Aborigines in Australia. But it's not a simple story. History never is a simple story. It's never a simple story of black, white, good, evil, right, wrong. There's always, of course, massive areas of gray. In this project of settler colonialism, it's not simply violent removal of the indigenous population. There's also, there are many examples of, yes, resistance, which brings on violence, but also accommodation, trade, alliances, religious conversion, marriage. Throughout the history of North American conflict between settlers and indigenous people, almost invariably, really from the outset until the 20th century, almost invariably, indigenous tribes allied with the colonizer, allied with the settler state, serving as scouts or regular armed forces. What Europeans and Euro-Americans and Americans provided often to Native American groups was an opportunity to ally with the colonizer against their more traditional indigenous enemies. So Europeans didn't bring warfare and violence to North America. Warfare and violence inhered in indigenous cultures and civilizations. Chieftainships and Indian tribes and bands had long been in conflict with one another. So, you know, we can't say that the Europeans arrived and there was a peaceful, idyllic world of indigenous people at one with nature, all these sort of romanticized notions. There was already violence on the conflict, but what it did was it exacerbated it. It accelerated it. So all of these characteristics I'm talking about here, we'll run through some examples of as we continue today. Finally, on these kind of overview initial points, let's keep in mind this is not unique to North America. Settler colonialism is a global, international phenomenon. And I've already mentioned Australia, other states where settlers arrived and created facts on the ground, removing indigenous populations, include South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, Israel, and there are many more. And in fact, as I said, this is an evolving arena of study, settler colonialism, and so people are exploring other venues, including involving China, involving Russia, involving all parts of the world. So there are many examples of this. All right, the reason I ended up going back in time, I'm interested in the violence within American foreign relations. What strikes me is a propensity to engage in warfare on a regular basis. In American history, there are not very many periods of time when the United States isn't going to war or prepared to go to war or at war when you look deeply into the matter. In many respects, one could argue that there's an element of the warfare state within United States history. And I think the violent settlement of the conflict, my sense was that this played a role, that you really had to go further back to understand even the wars on terror today, the way we conduct them, including often indiscriminate use of violence, often a lack of concern about casualties on the other end of American power. For example, Generals Schwarzkopf and Franks openly said, and a lot of this was in memory of controversies over Vietnam body counts. One of the measures of winning in Vietnam, which of course the United States did not do, was racking up body counts. So with the Persian Gulf War and then the Iraq War, both those generals were asked, well, what are the Iraqi casualties? And they both replied, we don't know, we're not keeping track, and we're not going to. So some other scholars have developed the concept of an American way of war, and this intrigued me, and so part of the reason I went into this area of study was to keep going back. It's not really something that you can prove empirically or link empirically. So when I start talking about Indian conflict in the 17th century, to relate that to today's war on terror, you can't really draw a direct line. So it's more inference. You have to use theory. And it's something more and appropriate, I hope, for the Hinckley Institute to think about, to consider, not necessarily to sit here and say that there's this direct link. But I think there's enough there to give us some pause to think about that. So as I argue here, as you see on the slide, we cannot adequately comprehend modern U.S. foreign relations as long as it remains severed from the settler colonial past. And so one thing historians have done and other scholars, there's been a tendency to understand that there were these Indian wars. They sort of ended with buried hearts at wounded knee, and then it was on to the 20th century in a whole new realm. And these two were separate. And I think they need to be connected. They need to be connected to understand identity and foreign relations and violence within foreign policy. All right, let me run through a few slides and give you some examples of some of these general points that I went over here. So in terms of some of the gray areas in between people, here's a couple. This William Johnson married a Mohawk woman within the Iroquois Confederation. He spoke their language. He understood their culture. He understood their ways of diplomacy. Indians conducted diplomacy. They just conducted diplomacy very differently from Europeans and Euro-Americans. The rituals, the process was very important to them. They weren't in a hurry. They didn't view it as, let's run in and sign a paper, carving out land that you can live here and we can live there. That was more the Euro-American way. Johnson was a go-between, as they're called. He understood Indians. There weren't enough of these people, but there were a lot of them. So in talking about these in-between, the gray areas, he's a good example. So is Joseph Brant there, whose real name was Thanon Daniega, which I'm sure I've butchered the pronunciation of. He is was an Iroquois, and in fact his sister married William Johnson, and he went to the future Dartmouth College, King's College. As you see there, he's doesn't appear like some whooping tomahawk carrying savage. He was multilingual, highly educated, and a very capable warrior and diplomat. So keep in mind this in-betweenness, the need to dispense with stereotypes to understand the colonial encounter. Here's the point about no virgin land, no wilderness. These are kind of terms and tropes that evolved over time. You know, the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, inhabited and settled the virgin continent. They named Virginia as if it were a virgin land. Nothing virginal about it. People lived there for centuries. There's no wilderness. It had all been touched and settled. When you look here at Mississippian culture, next time you guys are driving east on I-70, and if you get through Kansas without falling asleep, you can get to St. Louis, and on the other side, East St. Louis, you can find Cahokia here and visit the center of Indian civilization, of Mississippian culture, which expanded very widely. They had extensive trade routes, cities, towns, wars, conflict, all kinds of... So these were civilizations that existed. No virgin land, no empty wilderness.
Professor Walter Hickson teaches history at the University of Akron in Ohio. He's the author of American Settler Colonialism, A History. His research ties America's modern foreign policy and conflicts abroad, say in the Middle East, to the same culture of U.S. expansionism and violent settlement of North America. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, today we're hearing a unique perspective on the roots of U.S. foreign policy. Walter Hickson is a distinguished professor of history at the University of Akron and the author of American Settler Colonialism, A History.
Now, how'd I get into all this? I teach in Northeast Ohio, just south of Cleveland, home of the great LeBron James. They will win it all this year. And for 20 years, I taught there without knowing about this place, 30 miles south of where I lived in Akron. This is just off of I-71 south in Northeast Ohio, called Gnadenhütten. There's a historian here at Utah who knows this. Eric Hinderaker will be coming here later. He knows this area very well and did some tremendous research on the Ohio Valley. But I stopped at this site and read about this massacre. I thought, why didn't I know about this before? I'm a historian. I've lived here for 20 years. I doubt many of you know about it. Did anybody know about it? Anybody heard of Gnadenhütten? Yeah, it's an example of how we learn some things and we don't learn other things. That's the way history works. History functions for a purpose. There is a usable past. And history is crucial to any nation to have a sense of identity. But some things don't reflect in a way that creates a patriotic narrative. Some things are left out. Other things are emphasized. How did they end up doing this horrible violence at Gnadenhütten, where the summary executions in very brutal fashion of pacifist Delaware Indians who had converted to a European religion? Why? It was culminating an ethnic cleansing that had gone on across Pennsylvania. And this is a very fascinating story because the founder of Pennsylvania here, William Penn, was a Quaker and a pacifist. And he respected Indians, tried to learn about their languages, wanted to get along with them, had no desire to drive Indians out, much less kill them or destroy their cultures. But that's what happened in Pennsylvania. It was not something he could control. And the reason he couldn't control it is the subject I'm dealing with today, settlement. Waves of settlement, demographic swamping, masses of people coming with these ideas of building their own homelands, with their righteousness of sacred homelands in mind. Here's something else I didn't know about, bet none of you know about, maybe one or two. Who knows about this battle, the Battle of the Wabash? Actually, it doesn't really even have a formal name. In southwestern Ohio, completing the Indian removal, ethnic cleansing, settlement of Ohio. Listen to those terms, Indian removal. Ethnic cleansing, settlement. Depending on which term you use, it's either very benign or very aggressive and violent. See how much language matters in how we conceptualize things. I often tell students that's probably the most important thing you can understand. Examine the terms that you receive. Anybody know about this battle? No one. I didn't either. Until I lived in Ohio many years. You can see the casualty figures here. It was a total defeat for the United States Army, the worst it ever suffered. That's one reason you don't know about it. In the Indian Wars, it dwarfs the number of dead. I think it's 90 or 100 that Custer suffered. Everybody knows about that, right? We all know about Little Bighorn or the Battle of the Greasy Grass, as the Indians called the stream. But we didn't know about this one. The victory was short-lived. The Indians who won it knew. By the way, I went to this site, and it's a rocky little league baseball field with one little sign there now, so certainly not heavily marked or memorialized either. Here's a great quotation from Little Turtle, the Miami chief who won this war, but he knew that it couldn't last, that it was an ephemeral victory, that they were being driven out of their homelands. And said here, the whites were like leaves of the trees. When the frost comes, they fall and are blown away. But when the sunshine comes, again, they come back more plentiful than ever before. So it's these waves of settlers, the demographic swamping, that no matter how boldly they resist with these successes, such as the Sioux and their allies at Little Bighorn, ultimately, what's going on is an ethnic cleansing of the continent. Settlement, Indian removal. All right, so the Europeans are carrying this out, but as I suggested at the outset, other settler colonial venues exist, China, Russia, that are being explored by scholars in this relatively new field. But the Europeans came to North America with, armed with a worldview. Columbus, if you look into him, was not only a great and courageous navigator, but he was a religious zealot. He believed that he was expanding areas for Christendom. He was on a mission from God, and that the people he encountered in the Caribbean, he thought he was in Japan, but that's okay. This is why, of course, they're called Indians, and all those terms are problematic. Indians, Native Americans, all the terms are problematic. A lot of indigenous people accept the term Indian just because nothing else works particularly any better. When Columbus encountered the Arawaks, he noted one cut himself on a sword. He said, they know not modern technology. They would make good slaves. Enslavement ensued. This is another area of history that has been obscured. We all know about African slavery. And because of the tumult of race relations throughout United States history, which here's another example of deep-seated historical conflict that you must take all the way back. You can't understand race relations in America today without understanding this history of African slavery, of course. Neither can you understand, I think, U.S. actions in foreign relations, particularly against third world peoples, so-called, without really looking at these in more of a continental domestic context. So there was this history of Indian enslavement, mainly in the Southeast, but really all over the continent. As you can see here, Indians traded slaves mainly for guns and ammunition to fight their enemies, and sometimes to fight Europeans, whereas Europeans took Indian men for labor. That didn't work that well, so they turned to Africans. In part, Indians were dying in droves. As much as 90% of the indigenous population perished from disease. The main weapons Europeans brought were their germs. And to many of these Europeans, deeply religious, that was evidence of God's will to remove these people to make way for their sacred communities. Tremendous violence ensued, and this is what kind of intrigues me, and I try to link deep past and present over these wars of Indian slavery. Tribes had a choice, a real Hobson's choice, either be enslaved or participate in the European Indian slave trade. So Indian bands helped capture other Indians for sale because they risk that themselves. And this was very violent. So you have slave wars that go on for generations. Destroyed several tribes. So for example, if you travel to the Florida Panhandle, you can go to the Apalachicola National Forest near Florida State University, somewhere in that neighborhood. And that was where the Apalachee Indians were a very major group. They perished. But Indians reconfigured their identities, reformed as other groups. And some later tribes I'll talk about in a moment, like the Creek, the Cherokee, and others, they were created at this time from the remnants of the slave wars. All right, let's look at non-virgin Virginia. And this is something you do know about, you learned about in school, settlement at Jamestown, 1607. If you didn't learn about it in school, why, you learned about it from Walt Disney. And Pocahontas turns this into a love story. And indeed, it was a love story. She married John Rolfe, an Englishman, and removed to Europe, unfortunately. She was one of the victims of disease and died shortly thereafter. This is a depiction of her, quote-unquote, saving John Smith, something probably orchestrated by her father, the chieftain, to display his power. But rather than being just a love story, Virginia became a scene of violent Indian removal. A few decades later, this was an important historical event, Bacon's Rebellion. Maybe explaining that in a little more depth will illustrate some of the points that I want to make here. Bacon was an Englishman, a younger son. So in the European tradition of primogeniture, the eldest son received all of daddy's wealth and land. So younger sons like Bacon didn't have much to go with in Europe, and they were among these masses of Europeans who migrated to the New World, quote unquote, looking for new opportunities. However, by the time he got to Virginia, all the good land to cultivate tobacco and make money and have a good plantation life was taken. Moreover, Indian wars were costly, both in terms of lives and wealth, and the governor had decreed a limit on settlement, told people, you cannot go beyond this point into Indian land. We don't want another Indian war right now. Bacon said, no way. That's easy for you to say. You've got your land and plantation. They are just savages and heathens. To hell with them. We're going. And he and a band launched the Bacon's Rebellion, went into the Virginia countryside, drove out Native American groups to establish new plantations. Now, you're not allowed to defy the governor and the king, so they called out the militia, and Virginia devolved into a civil war. Virginia had a civil war over settler colonization. Bacon won. Unfortunately, he dropped dead, probably from dysentery, and new troops arrived, and they put down the rebellion. But it illustrates a very important point in American history, in the history of settler colonization. Settlers will not be stopped, neither by indigenous people nor by the government. So a lot of our anti-government attitudes in the United States, how often do you hear politicians talk about too much government, roll back government, usually in every realm except foreign policy and national security? Exception to that, interestingly enough, Rand Paul. He says, let's roll that back too. What sense does it make to have criticized big government domestically and love it in foreign policy? It's very interesting. We'll see how that debate plays out. Anyway, I forget what I was talking about now. So let's move on to something you know about here, Thanksgiving. We all know about this, right? We eat too freaking much on this Thursday in late November. Sit around and watch football. Have fun with the family. This, of course, is a holiday that Americans celebrate that harkens back to Plymouth and early settlement, and depicts, much like Pocahontas depicting Virginia as a love story, this depicts New England settlement as a picnic. Now, they indeed met and had this meal and celebrated the harvest, but there was tremendous and savage violence in Indian removal in New England. The Pequot War here is one example. A war you may not know much about, King Philip's War, proportionally to population, the most devastating conflict in North American history. A war without mercy waged by both sides, with indiscriminate killing, mutilation, terrible violence. So this is what interests me, that these deep roots of identifying savage enemy others and indiscriminate conflict with them, to some extent, I believe this carries into today. And that's kind of the linkage I'm trying to explore through my investigations of settler colonialism. And as I said at the outset, you cannot. It requires theorization. It's not something that you can prove. But I do think worth exploring.
Walter Hickson is professor of history at the University of Akron and the author of American Settler Colonialism, A History. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, for the whole hour, we're airing a talk given recently by Professor Walter Hickson. He's a distinguished professor of history at the University of Akron. He was in Utah recently and spoke about his research into America's history and settlement of North America. Hickson takes a unique approach of trying to link modern United States foreign policy today to America's expansionist and violent legacy of settlement of North America. By the way, Professor Hickson is also currently researching a new book examining the role of the United States in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Again, this is Walter Hickson.
Let's keep rolling here to look at the French and Indian War. By its title, you understand well that Indians played a prominent role. Indeed, they did. General Braddock, depicted here, came to fight with the British against the French. Francis Parkman called this the Great War for Empire. Whoever won this would control the continent. Indeed, the British won, took control of the continent. But initially, they lost. Braddock was a good example of why. He came in with his bright red coat. He and his officers rode their horses prancing into the Pennsylvania woods. They took a band. And back to that term I gave you at the outset, the American way of war. This guerrilla conflict, guerrillas attacked them and devastated Braddock. He was killed. George Washington's horse was shot out from under him. He got lucky and survived. Masses of these men were killed. It was a total defeat by the French and the Indians. Now, before the conflict, some locals in America, people like Benjamin Franklin, understood that you better talk to the Indians. You better take them into consideration. They know the lay of the land. They can help you. So Braddock sat down with the Delaware chieftain named Shingas and talked about, okay, what do you know? And Shingas said, well, I might be able to help you, but I want preservation of my lands. I mean, I got to get something out of this. And Braddock said, no savage shall inherit the land. And Shingas said, see you later. Good luck. And Braddock did not have good luck. In the wake of this war, there's tremendous amount of violence. This is where the American military tradition, of course, you've all heard of the Army Rangers. Ranging and scalp hunting date back to this period. So when I grew up as a kid, watched the whooping savages on TV westerns, I assumed that all the savagery and mutilation and so forth was done by Indians on account of they were savages. Actually, there was a great deal of mutilation on the part of Euro-Americans. For example, a little bit later when we get, let's just go there and skip a little bit here, to the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. If you look at your $20 bill, there's a fine portrait of Andrew Jackson on it, which if you scope him up on the internet, you'll find a more revealing actual painting of him than the one we put on the $20 bill. But in any case, General Jackson became a military hero in the Battle of New Orleans. But before that, he led the victory at Horseshoe Bend in Alabama. And to illustrate this point about mutilation on both sides, they cut the tips off of about 400 Creeks' noses to take an accurate body count of the conflict. So scalping, mutilating, this was done by Euro-Americans to demonstrate their success in the field as well as by Indians. All right, there's a lot I could talk about, but this expansion continues. The so-called Mexican War, one of the interesting aspects of it is that the U.S. victory over Mexico was aided by the Comanche and the Kiowa and some other tribes who had really softened up the northern Mexican frontier by really brutal attacks on Hispanic settlements. And the Hispanic settlers were angry with the Mexican government for not protecting them. Many of them welcomed the American attackers. Here's a book by a University of Oklahoma historian. He's certainly not a University of Texas historian. And the subtitle to this book, if you can see it here in fine print, is it's called The Conquest of Texas, The Ethnic Cleansing of the Promised Land. And so some scholars, like myself, like Gary Anderson in this book, are using this term that emerged in the 90s in association with the Balkans to really underscore and to kind of destabilize this benign term settlement. Ethnic cleansing is not a benign term. So really, it's not to say this is right and settlement's wrong. The real issue is to think about these terms and to analyze them. But he used it in the title of his book. All right, you'll remember I said this is not a uniquely American phenomenon. The country that most resembles the U.S. pattern was Australia. There was a tremendous amount of brutal violence in Australian settlement. By the time settlers got to California, I think we can use another controversial word, the G word, genocide. There's no government in California. By the time settlers got there in the 1850s, they were just killing all Indians. The governor of California said, "Go kill the Indians." It was totally unambiguous and lacked subtlety. It was genocidal. In Queensland and Australia, something very similar occurred. The settlers went in and they killed the indigenous people and took their lands. All right, I extend settler colonialism to Alaska. The United States purchased this great land. That's what Alaska means in the Aleut language. Sight unseen, virtually, and with complete indifference to the natives who lived there. And that was a familiar pattern. In the treaty ending the Revolutionary War, you can see the map here, the British granted the American demand at the treaty for borders to the Mississippi. The British gave them that, but in fact, these lands were all inhabited by other people already. They weren't the British lands to give. Similarly, in the Louisiana Purchase, Napoleon sold masses of territory to Americans that were inhabited by other people. Those are the kind of things to keep in mind. This I skipped over, but the infamous Trail of Tears, Indian removal in the Southeast. What was distinctive about this was that it was legislated. Congress openly debated ethnic cleansing and voted quite narrowly, and there was quite a bit of opposition. A lot of people said, this isn't right. After all, look at the Cherokee. They dress like us. They live in homes like us. They've adopted gender roles like we have. Men are farmers. Women take care of the home. Appropriate gender role in the 19th century. My gosh, they're so American, they own slaves. And they did. The Cherokee were slave owners. How can we justify this? Well, the Cherokee wanted to keep an independent land. They had their own constitution, their own laws. The Supreme Court said, no, you're not independent, you're domestic dependent nations. And Jackson and the settlers said they got to go. Loaded them up, removed them. It was horrific. Lots died from disease and starvation. The supplies they were supposed to get, the new homes they were supposed to get, they weren't there. So, I said at the outset, not uniquely American, talked about Australia. Here's an example with European colonialism. So U.S. expansion is in a context when other Europeans are involved in what historians refer to as the scramble for Africa, for example. The British are carving out treaty ports with the French and China. There's a global colonialist movement. American settler colonialism and then U.S. overseas colonialism happen in this context. So this is where I think we take the jump to places like Alaska, Hawaii, and especially the Philippines. And this is where that separation I referred to in the outset exists. Okay, we can quit talking about America. The frontier's closed. Now let's talk about foreign policy. What I'm saying is, nope, I think foreign policy goes back. That Indians were foreign people. That was foreign policy. That's really the essence of what I'm trying to do with settler colonialism. Here in Hawaii, gradually Americans took over and changed the Hawaiian system of land distribution, overthrew the monarchy, took Hawaii. You all live in Utah. I think this is probably a familiar story. You've heard what Theodore Roosevelt called here, and I put in quotation marks, the winning of the West. There's a good example. Winning the West. Ethnic cleansing of the West. These are very different connotations. So, is it all ethnic cleansing? No. There's a lot of accommodation, a lot of trade, a lot of cooperation. There's also warfare. There's also child removal. There are many interesting stories. For example, Ouray, the Ute chieftain, I'm sure you've heard of. He was a celebrated Indian leader. He was feted in New York and Washington, conducted diplomacy. He was highly skilled, kept the Ute lands for a long time. In fact, the Ute probably came off like the Navajo and some other tribes better than some others. All right, the Civil War leaders were pretty dedicated ethnic cleansers. The same things that had been done to the Confederacy, these men that you see here, Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan, applied in the West. So I think there's a lot of continuity then when we move overseas to the Philippines. And if you read about the Philippine conflict, I'm going to try to wrap up here in a minute, get some questions from you all, and just run through some of these examples. What I'm trying to say here is I think things like this indiscriminate warfare in the Philippines is not unrelated to this prior history on the continent. We shouldn't cut it off because it's thousands of miles away. The same forces were at work against treacherous, savage, terroristic enemies. Maybe even in the good war, World War II, where you may not be aware of the amount of indiscriminate killing that went on against Europeans and especially against the Japanese. The distinctions between civilian and military targets eroded completely in World War II. The treacherous Japs, as they were routinely called, you see the propaganda poster here, who had bombed Pearl Harbor. You won't usually see it referred to the way I've written it in my recent work, bombed the U.S. colony of Pearl Harbor. You may not have read it that way before. That's what it was. Vietnam, Persian Gulf War, shock and awe. So these examples of indiscriminate violence, I think, have some roots in this settler colonial past. And that's what I'm grappling with. And again, don't claim to see a clear line of demarcation. All right, let's sum up with some looks at settler colonial society today. One of the interesting things about settler colonialism, and another distinction with colonialism, so under normal colonialism, the French finally get kicked out of Indochina in 1954. The Dutch leave Indonesia in 1949. There's an end. There's no end to settler colonialism. It never ends. It's going on today. Now, in the 90s, when some of these issues were native sovereignty movement and other issues were coming up, this is something also you may not have heard of. Most people haven't. The U.S. government has officially apologized to Hawaii. Sorry, we took it from you. No compensation. The U.S. was very disturbed by the U.N. Declaration of Indigenous Rights of Indigenous People. First voted against it, later only accepted it with a disclaimer emphasizing U.S. ultimate authority over these, over Indigenous people. How many of you knew that the U.S. had formally apologized to Native Americans, Indigenous people? Just a couple. It came here in 2010, and as I emphasize here, the irony, I guess, was lost on them. To me, it's ironic. It was deeply embedded in a defense appropriations bill. Whereas in Australia and New Zealand, these were very public ceremonial events, highly publicized. Here, it was done. You can see the language here, official apologies for the past ill-conceived policies toward Native peoples, but it was done very quietly, so that you've never heard of. The conditions, as you may know, on reservations today remain as they've often been. Obviously, they do vary, but any kind of economic index or social index you want to take, education, income, alcoholism, pick one. They are typically near the bottom. The conditions on reservations are dire, called by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights a quiet crisis. So this is a legacy of settler colonialism. Settler colonialism still exists in this respect. But resistance continues. There are victories, especially in court. One of the differences between the U.S. and Australia officially declared the continent empty. Whereas the United States, many of the American founding fathers were very uncomfortable about Indian relations. I mean, Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal." You know what else he wrote in that? "The king has unleashed the," quote, "merciless Indian savages," unquote, "on our frontier." But he was conflicted. Many of them were conflicted. And so the United States said, we cannot just take these people's lands. We must purchase it from them, legally by treaty. And of course, there's a long history of fraudulent treaties. But what happened is Indians can hire lawyers too. And in the modern period, beginning in the 70s, they started to win victories. And this is how you get the Indian casinos and some land reclaiming on the part of Native Americans, lots of other things. So resistance continues. Native sovereignty movement continues. Some Indians insist on traveling on their own passports. I don't want a U.S. passport. I don't want a Canadian passport. I'm an Iroquois. I'm a sovereign Iroquois. I'm not. I'm speaking for them. There's no Indian in me that I know of. But it's an example of how they're trying to exert and press their sovereignty. So settler colonialism and its legacies continue. Here's one I know you all are familiar with. The mascot controversy. This came up here at Utah, and the reason you all are still the Utes is that the Utes signed off on it. But it remains very controversial with other Indian tribes, with some Utes, and I know you all are probably more familiar with this over the years than I am. There's been some controversy here, but not nearly as much as some other places. What happened is that the NCAA threatened to withhold funding for federal funds for sports, along with the federal government, under laws of the land, if there was discrimination and mistreatment of minorities, which these depictions were deemed to be. This was a particularly sharp controversy with Chief Illiniwek of the University of Illinois, the Illini. It's a bitter fight there. And as you can see, there's the chief's. The chief was actually typically a white student who danced like he thought Indians danced in Illinois at halftime of games with all the feathered regalia you see here. He was retired in 2007, but the Illini lost their chieftain. The Utah kept the Utes. And by the way, good luck. I don't like Duke. Go ahead and whip their butts. You know about this, the tomahawk chop. I think if you're a baseball fan, you've seen Atlanta Braves fans do it. Florida State got permission from the Seminole tribe in Florida to keep their mascot. However, most Seminoles live in Oklahoma, and the Seminole headquarters in Oklahoma opposes it. They even named this student figure here Chief Osceola after a real Seminole resistance leader. By the way, the Seminole War in the 1850s was the Vietnam War of its era. It went on and on and on, and the Seminole were very effective at resistance. How about this one? I know you've heard of this. Everybody's an NFL fan in America. So, Daniel Snyder, the Washington Redskins. It's been very controversial. Redskins is particularly neuralgic because not only there's a strong kind of racist connotation to that. Indians, this was a demeaning term for Indians, Redskins. It also is suggestive of the mutilation, because sometimes people would present red skin to show their triumph in battle over Indians. So, okay, it's sports teams. Get over it. It's not that big a deal, right? That's what people say. Here's what the National Conference of American Indians, National Committee of American Indians, says about that. How do you like that? Stereotypical New York Jews with a smiling, stereotypical Hebrew icon on the cap. How about the San Francisco Chinaman with an obviously racist, stereotypical buck-toothed Chinaman? And then the contemporary cap of the Cleveland Indians in my part of the United States. The Indians will not change their name or their logo. And although they have said that the Block C is their primary logo today. So what the National Congress of American Indians is saying here is, oh, really? You think it's benign? How would you like this? I once, just to be the troublemaker that I am, suggested we should call our Akron baseball team, Double A team, not the Arrows, but the White Trash. You can imagine that it didn't go over real well. Well, that's the point the National Congress of American Indians is trying to make here. And so when you say it's benign, it's just a game, it's just a sports team, that's what they say. So it's an example of settler colonialism as an enduring framework. It's not over, it's never over. A big difference between traditional colonialism and settler colonialism. So I hope maybe this would make some of you think differently about this or support it. I can see how it would be injurious. Another aspect of this, the Army is rather fond of appropriating Indian names, especially of helicopters. There have been a whole series of these. But one of their main ones, very active, as I say here, a workhorse in the Iraq War, was the Kiowa attack helicopter. So appropriating Indian names for U.S. militarism when there's this whole history of Indian warfare and resistance and conquering of native tribes by the Americans. So these things are troubling to many, many Native American groups. Let me wrap up here and get some questions from you all. So here are some of the conclusions that I come to. I've already talked about a lot of this, but I'm trying to link the foreign policy present and recent past with the deep past and link continental foreign policy as I perceive it, not Western expansion, but foreign relations with Indians, with more modern foreign policy. And there are some troubling and sweeping conclusions that, you know, I don't expect everybody to draw, and again, I don't purport to prove. This is not really provable. This is more things for us to think about and analyze. But it does seem to me that this long history of traumatic, righteous violence against enemy others, savage enemy others, with the demonizing discourse, has made something of an imprint and can also help explain U.S. close relationships with other quote-unquote white settler societies. So I conclude, by identifying the United States as a settler state, we can more effectively work toward justice for Native people and by extension for settlers as well, especially for the United States with its driving sense of mission, its incomparable military power and global influence, but also its propensity for destruction. A more honest reckoning with the past is indispensable prelude to the construction of a more peaceful future. Thank you. Please, I'm happy to have any questions or comments. I'm still learning all the time, and I learn from people in these settings. So,
all right, so if you have a question, please state your name, maybe your major, something about you. Speak into the mic.
Hello, my name is Hui Lei, and my major is social justice pedagogy. And my question is connected to the narrative that's nationally right now with people calling themselves Native, mm-hmm. and they're scared of invaders, and they're talking mostly about like Latinos coming to America. Mm-hmm. And what would you share in, I guess, that context to those that say, I'm Native, not Native American, but I'm Native, and I don't like invaders coming to my country.
Right. Yeah, it's a good question and another example of contemporary relevance of this issue. And, you know, one thing I've done in this talk is not talked about much. I mentioned the so-called Mexican War, but about Hispanic settlers. And there was also, well, I did mention Gary Anderson's book and the ethnic cleansing of Texas. That involved not only Indians, but Hispanic peoples. One of the things a lot of people don't understand, and I'm no expert on the modern immigration issue, but I know a lot of people aren't fully aware that even as you framed it, it's not so much the majority of people seeking citizenship were born here. Their parents came, often legally, but stayed illegally. But they were born and raised here. And so they're natives. You know, they were born here. They're as native as you can be. So they're Americans. And so that is where I would start in that debate, is pointing out to people who don't know that, that these people are people who were in fact born in the country, and they're just as native as anybody else born in the country. So other than that, and to, you know, this is why it's a good example of why history is important. While some of us in higher education are troubled by the emphasis on what they call STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Look, we got plenty of weapons in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's not the problem. We got great weapons. What we don't have is much historical understanding of these people and their culture and their religions. That's the stuff of history and anthropology and liberal arts. So science and technology is great, got to have it, so is history. And so one answer to your question is, hey, you know, none of us are natives, except maybe the 5 million plus indigenous people who still live in this country.
Hi, my name is Shayla Archer. My
like
question,
your shirt.
Thank you.
She's got a Utah shirt on.
My question is, you mentioned that you have a particular interest in violence in American foreign relations.
Yes.
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about, and you kind of did overall, but as far as our super bloody, like, beginning in this country, how do you think our current foreign relations or current foreign policy reflects that? Or have we evolved, and are things like the U.S. Patriot Act evidence that we haven't? Or, you know, just could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gets at the crux of what I'm trying to do, and it's really a hard question to answer. And as I've said repeatedly, I can't really, in any empirical way, make that connection or prove it, quote unquote. But I do think there's a connection, and I do see a lot of continuity. Historians deal a lot with continuity versus discontinuity. The more things stay the same or the more they're different. And I do see these connections and linkages, but, you know, it's always complicated. Back to the gray areas. The United States willingly engages in trade, in diplomacy, in soft power. It's often very effective. But it also engages in indiscriminate violence. And that's the part I think we often elide or skip over or obscure that we must grapple with. So it's not the sum total of who we are, but it's part of who we are. And I think it's deeply rooted. And, you know, the reason I talk about it, even though it's not a very happy subject, is that's the reason.
My name is Julian Anderson. I'm a student of computer science. I just would like to know what you think about all those billions of dollars that we spend in Israel every year and how they are implementing their war against the Palestinians and all the division and racial division that's going on there.
Yes, well, I mean, it's a hard question to answer succinctly, but I am giving a talk about it tonight at the public library, and you're all welcome to come to that. I'm keenly interested in the subject, and it's certainly a reflection of settler colonialism. Israel is a settler society. And it's also a society of peopled by human beings who suffered a horrific trauma. Of course, the Nazi Holocaust is what I'm referring to. And so when I talked at the outset here about a characteristic of settlers of righteous violence, of sacred missions, this is very much in play with Israel. So there's a sense of entitlement and of righteousness and also of being traumatized. And this gets into a realm I certainly can't prove empirically. It's psychological. But I think Israelis are, in a sense, traumatized people. And in a horrible human tragedy, as your question suggests, they've taken that out on the residents of the territories. And it's a very complicated issue, and yet it's a very simple issue. It's not, I think, as a lot of Americans see it, well, there's this side and there's that side, and they've been in conflict forever. That's not what it is. What it is people, since the 1967 war, illegally, under international law, under the United Nations, occupying land that does not belong to them, and making it impossible for the people who live there to have lives. And it was very, very revealing that in order to ensure his election at the last minute, Netanyahu told the truth on the day before the election and said what has been going on for decades, Come on, it's been decades. It's time to acknowledge they're not interested in creating a viable Palestinian homeland. They're interested in settlement and expanding their own homelands, which they have done for these decades. So it is a very complicated subject, and there are a lot of Israelis and a lot of American Jews who are not happy with Israeli policy. This is not a Jew versus Arab issue. This is a settler versus indigenous people issue. But a lot of American Jews and others are troubled by this and oppose it. On the other hand, there are a lot of American fundamentalist Protestants who are absolutely uncritical and gung-ho for Israel for biblical reasons. But there, that last slide that I mentioned to you, some of the implications I had on there, this settler colonial past also helps you understand the American affinity for white settler societies. Israel's a great example. The special relationship. Okay, thank you all.
That's Walter Hickson, professor of history at the University of Akron and author of American Settler Colonialism, A History. If you want to see the picture of the caricatures of the three ball caps he's describing there at the last part of that talk, you can see that on our website. I'm Ross Chambliss, your producer and host. Tune in next week. Thanks.